Hello? Okay, thank you. Thank you everybody for getting back so promptly. I know we cut off the break about 5 minutes last time, but thank you very much. Okay, right. I'd now like to introduce John Alexander, who's development engineer for Glacier Energy. So over to you, John.
So, good morning. Thanks for Foresight for arranging this event, sponsored partly by Glacier Energy. We're looking forward to obviously hearing from everybody else today, but today, just to introduce myself, I'm John Alexander, as I said, I'm a development engineer for Glacier Energy. Today we're planning to share our journey into Type 4 hydrogen storage and what we've done today and where we're going in the future. So a little bit about Glacier Energy. Glacier Energy is a privately equity-backed company formed in 2011. It's grown both organically and through acquisitions. Headquartered in Aberdeen, we have a long tradition and history in oil and gas, with a track record of a huge customer base. Our design and manufacturing division specializes in the manufacture of pressure vessels and heat exchangers for the last 120 years. So how did we move into renewables? Several things happened within a similar time period that set us on into renewables. The UK government issued a 10-point plan in 2020, along with a hydrogen strategy in 2021. Along with that, clusters were therefore formed around the UK, focusing on hydrogen energy. From that, we realised that most renewable products require heat exchangers and pressure vessels of various different types. It was evident that we naturally had what the industry required in a wide range of renewable sectors, as several different renewable technologies require heat exchangers and storage. We rewrote our business plan, which included diversification into renewables, and we studied the market, which identified companies which were involved in renewable projects that we decided to get in contact with. So during the summer of 2021, we employed four engineering interns for 11 weeks to try and review and see what would happen for our standard product for our company. We gave them the brief to be manufactured by Glacier for the renewable energy sector. An in-house collaboration resulted in the consensus that we should be developing a range of hydrogen storage and distribution vessels. This was liked into the government strategy. With various funding calls, we knew that hydrogen storage and distribution was going to be required within the UK. So as you'll know, research and development of a new product is expensive, so we sought out funding and development partners. We were successful in that, and we embarked on a funding and R&D project with RGU, that's Robert Gordon's University in Aberdeen. The idea was to use our manufacturing experience of working with various metals combined with RGU's experience of composites to develop lightweight Type 3 hydrogen vessels. However, R&D doesn't really go as well as what you want it to sometimes, so we went down a particular path, an output which didn't fulfil their project aims. The vessel was not as commercially viable, nor was it as lightweight as we needed it to be to satisfy the market conditions. However, lots of good work was carried out by RGU and ourselves in this project, and we learnt a lot. What we knew is Type 3 was not our future, but we moved into Type 4. Glacier recognised that we needed more in-house expertise and knowledge to enhance the in-house engineering team. We carried out market analysis to understand who was supplying and to whom. This helped us identify what gaps there was in the market for us to enter into. All of this coincided with Glacier Energy obtaining new private equity investors who aligned with our journey into renewable energy. This would be based upon supporting renewable energy projects with a focus on volume manufacturing, not just for hydrogen, but also for renewable technologies that we were working on. So part of that market research, we also did technical research into what was currently out there, what's in the market. And from a technical point of view, we discovered the following. Current market for hydrogen storage and transportation uses many different types of manufacturing methods. One of the current carbon fibre cylinder technology uses a liquid resin formula, and which is probably just called wet wrap in the industry. This contains a relatively high wastage of composite, anything up to 30%. It's also very messy from a volume manufacturing point of view. There's a lot of resin lost during the manufacture, requiring machinery to have daily clean downs, which is a huge loss in production time when you're upscaling into higher volume. We also found that the liners used for a composite cylinder are either used rotomolding or blow-molding technology. And rotomolding in particular, it uses a very high amount of energy because it goes into gas burners and it's externally heated to liquefy the plastic. So moving into this, we decided that, well, we can't do it alone. So we needed to accelerate our entry into the market. And to do that, we partnered up with certain technology experts. Furthermore, most of that was we identified the main aspects of the Type 4 vessel, which was the carbon wrap, the liner, and the embosses. To that, we ended up working with the National Composite Centre, who have they have state-of-the-art design and testing facilities. We are engaged closely with an equipment supplier who supplies filament winding systems and is aiding in our design process. We have a plastic molding business partnership who will supply revolutionary liners as a dedicated supply chain. And all of the parties have come together working on this when their end goal providing the most technically advanced Type 4 cylinder that we can manage. So a little bit of detail into what that technology is. We're looking at the liners, and as we said, current form is a form of rotomolding, but we want to move to the next level, something that's already in the market, but we want to move to electric rotomolding. And what this means is that this has a much higher efficiency. So these contain an all-in-one mold that's self-heated. It doesn't have an external heating source, so it's a very efficient form of creating the liner. The system is automated for a start, and it's monitored throughout the molding process. So what we can do is then control cooling the liner down at a steady pace to ensure that we have a very high accuracy in the thickness of the liners. We've got down to fractions of a millimeter in terms of the accuracy of the thickness, which going forward into the Type 4 testing is very important. And with the winding technology, as I said, we're working with the NCC and we're working with our equipment manufacturers. We had a look at the different types of winding. As we say, we have wet wrap. Now, the wet wrap drags a carbon fibre filament through a bath of resin, and as I say, it's a very messy process. There is another technology out there, and it's called Topreg. And what this is a pre-impregnated carbon fibre that actually has the resin already in the product as it gets wound on. This is a dry process, a very accurate process. However, the raw materials are more expensive. But when we did our analysis, we can learn your downtime, your mess, your quality. It was a much more advanced product. It has only a 2% wastage compared to the 30% of a wet wrap. It's faster, more effective method of wrapping, but it's a consistency. The consistency of not having inclusions and gaps in your wind mean that you've got a much better product at the end of the day. It performs better, and but the fundamental aspect is that because it performs better, we get to use less of it. So this is a real-time 20% reduction in carbon fibre we need to use for our vessels. And then that transfers into a 12 to 15% reduction in the overall weight of our cylinder. So our target at the end of this as well is to make sure that we have as low retention as possible of hydrogen left in the Type 4 vessel. As you may or may not know, you cannot fully empty a Type 4 vessel once it's been pressurised. You have to leave a remaining amount of hydrogen within the vessel, which gives you the difference between usable hydrogen and total volume of hydrogen. So for us, we are aiming to have as low residual hydrogen as possible in our vessels, again, making them more efficient and better for the industry. So as I said, we were working with NCC because it's easy to say all this stuff, but it's different to actually prove it. And that's what we've been doing. So we've been doing testing such as CT scanning, tensile tests, thickness measurements, and all of this has been analysed, and the data we're getting back is proving our point. We're getting a level of consistency within, again, fractions of a millimetre again on the thickness of the actual carbon fibre that's going down onto the vessel. We have a level of control over this, which means that it's very reproducible. You know, we'll be able to get consistency time and time again on every form of manufacturing. But as you all know, you need to get things certified. We can't go into this industry without making sure that we meet all the industry standards and all the products. So for this cylinder, it's the EN17339 testing. Some of you may or may not be aware of this, but this is along with EC79 for assemblies and for cylinders, we picked the EN17339. What this does effectively is that this gets us testing for cycling, for impact, for fire. These are some of the main highlights, and each time we've got to make sure that our cylinders pass this before we'll get certification. So where does this kind of lead us? Well, this is our product that we're bringing to the market. We're going to bring a 40-foot MEGC that will be on trailer to the market. It's going to be 380 bar, and it's going to hit the market Q2 2026. We're also looking at 20-foot variations of this because, there's a demand for different sizes. So some of the highlights for what Glacier is bringing to this product is the fact that we will have a fully integrated solution. We will have our own in-house frame design and manufacture, our own fabrication facilities for our cylinders, and this allows us to keep full control of the supply chain of the cylinders and the assemblies and the certification of that. We plan to have them dual certified so they'll be able to transport from UK to Europe and back again with hydrogen. And like I say, for us entering this market, we are looking for the quality. We want to be able to know that our products are at a certain level of quality and a certain level of safety. And to that, it's very important for us that our brand is known to be associated with safety and quality. But to accompany that with most products on the market, but especially for this, is that we need to provide a servicing. Our facility that we're planning to build will have full hydro tests and recertification facilities for our cylinders. We'll also be able to do full leak tests and of the assemblies and have them re-stamped and certified for all our customers. Because it's a service centre, we'll be able to provide replacement cylinders, piping, valving, and instrumentation. And the service centre will be based in the UK, but we will also have mobile servicing available to customers for overseas. So moving forward, hydrogen journey to date has been a bit exciting, but it's also been very challenging. We've learned a lot during our journey, but it's not over. We're just at the beginning of this because we can see huge potential for all sorts of different products. We've got a clear strategy, robust investors, and a talented team with specialist technical partners. We've got a product range which is required for by hundreds of projects. We can't do it alone. We need to continue to work with our customers, funding agencies, and suppliers to deliver high quality and relevant products. So an exciting time for Glacier and the market as a whole. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much, John. I'd now like to introduce James Milner from Wild Hydrogen, who's the CEO of Wild Hydrogen. So,
thank you. Good morning, everyone. Right, I'm going to lay out a vision. So imagine a future where every pint of beer that you drink removes CO2 from the atmosphere. Every time you have a shower, you remove CO2 from the atmosphere. Every time you get on an aeroplane, you remove CO2 from the atmosphere. And at Wild Hydrogen, our little small team, for the last 3 years, has been living and dreaming this vision, and now we're a step closer to becoming a reality. So we're a startup. We've got breakthrough technology. We compete incredibly well against not only electrolyzed hydrogen, but actually fossil fuel hydrogen. So we have a very simple mission, and that is to replace fossil fuels at pace. I'm getting old, my board's getting old, they're pushing me to get this technology and exploit it as quickly as possible. So I'm really pleased to have the opportunity to launch this technology at this event and talk to people. We've got a stand downstairs. So for the next 10 minutes or so, I'm just going to explain what we're about and why we think this is compelling. So we're in the molecules business, okay? So we talked this morning was a little bit about electricity and electrons. I'm an electrical engineer. I love electrons. I'm now converted to molecules. And let's leave the electrons in the electricity grid. The gas grid carries 3 to 4 times more energy than the electricity grid. We need to decarbonize the gas grid. The gas grid is an incredible achievement across the world in terms of transporting energy. If we look at where the progress is in getting green molecules into the gas grid, then we've got biomethane from anaerobic digesters, which I'm sure many of you in the room are very aware of. Fantastic technology, works well, making money for people, competes against fossil fuels. 2% of our molecules in the gas grid are green. In Denmark, 40% of the gas molecules in their gas grid are green because they've had a real push on anaerobic digesters and gasification plants. But it comes with issues, especially in the UK. Land is at a premium, got a restricted feedstock range, and it's pretty inefficient when it comes to conversion efficiency. Green hydrogen, as we're learning, it's expensive. We need large grid connections. Now, I'm not bashing these. I'm just saying we've got another technology which I think is of interest, and that is using a system which is called supercritical water hydrolysis or reforming. This is a chemistry that's very well understood in the lab. There's peer-reviewed papers right around the world from academic institutions. And the reason that so much interest has happened in those academic institutions is because it is the holy grail of converting biogenic materials into useful product and gases. Nobody has engineered their way out of the lab until now. That's what we've done. We can take any biogenic material. That could be grown fuels that would go into an AD. It could be wood waste. It could be plastic waste. It could be sewage streams. Anything that has an organic component to it. We put that into our rising pressure reformer, and we get 4 very useful products: biomethane, hydrogen, biochar, and carbon dioxide. We can tune the reactor conditions to favor either biomethane or hydrogen. More on that later. Supercritical water, for those that aren't familiar with this, and I wasn't when I first started the company, now I think this is an incredible phase of water. Challenging conditions. You know, it's very high temperatures, very high pressures, 240 bar at very high temperatures. We're operating to make hydrogen about 800 degrees at 240 bar, hence why you can see the challenge of getting out of that lab. We've done that, we've got it proven, we've had the tires kicked on this technology by a number of institutions, including Cranfield, CPI, MTC, and others. That sort of area where the supercritical is, that sort of here be dragons when it comes to scale. So a lot of the R&D that we're doing is understanding where's the sweet spot here. That's from an energy efficiency perspective, from the mix of gases, and from the yield, etc. What we found is higher pressure is not that favorable. In fact, it pushes against the equilibriums. So we just need to flip over to about 240 bar. Then we can change the temperature, and that in changing that temperature conditions will favor hydrogen or biomethane. What's our prototype journey? Millie was designed in my kitchen, tested at Cranfield University. Nano is our lab scale. Micro and mini. Micro is in the workshop, mini's in the car park. So we've engineered our way out of the lab. We're now in the car park with kilowatts of gas that we're producing daily. Micro and mini are first of a kind in the world. We've done this with the help of our engineering partners, Helical Energy, and they're working with lots of university spin-outs in terms of getting them, and they've got a good track record of getting these breakthrough technologies up to pilot scale and beyond. What are we doing next? We're building a 1 megawatt unit. That will be ready in 2028. Now you think 1 megawatt, that's not going to move the needle. But these are modular reactors. So in order to scale up, we just build more. So think about electrolyzers and the scale-up journey for them. This is the same, but with gas. We have a patent that's been granted, and that's in 14 regions around the world. If we look at what does carbon negative fuel actually mean, this is IPCC data. So 100 megawatts of energy use over 100 years is that line that's going up there. That's 25 million tons of CO2 into the atmosphere over 100 years. If we go to try and maintain 2 degrees C with IPCC and increased acceleration of green energy, we're still going to put 15 million tons of CO2 into the atmosphere with that 100 megawatts of energy. With our carbon negative solution, then we're looking at removing all of that CO2. This has got the ear of people like Microsoft and others who want to offset their historic emissions. So this is where we're starting to get traction with customers who are very interested in a carbon negative solution. If we have a look at just the UK fossil fuel market, very familiar numbers on here, £300 billion market in natural gas, jet fuel, petrol and diesel. Our first target market is going to be biomethane. We're not relying then on a nascent hydrogen market. We remove the chicken and egg. And pleased to announce today, we've signed the contract, the ink is still wet, with Wales and West, and they're our first industrial partner. So a paid pilot is kicked off this week. And we'll start with biomethane injected into the gas grid, and we'll move to hydrogen when policy allows. And we can do that blending and put that into the grid, and that's what the paid pilot is showing. By the way, that 54 terawatt hours of addressable market, that is based on the amount of biogenic material that is available in the UK that is currently going to landfill, being incinerated, or ending up being shipped abroad. So these are waste streams that we can turn into useful molecules to decarbonize the grid. So this is our prototype journey, log scale. So be aware. We want to move to a commercial demonstrator of 1 megawatt. That will end up being the production unit. We've got a factory where we're going to be building these units. And you can see our journey through the prototypes and what we've raised so far. We've got a really strong board, in particular David Gammon. Those that aren't familiar, he is an absolute advocate for UK breakthrough tech. He was a founder of DeepMind. He loves incredible engineering challenges, so he was part of the initial start of AI. He found us and said, I love this technology, I love the fact you've engineered your way out of the lab, I'm determined to make this a success. So having him on board as my personal mentor is fantastic. Last year, he floated Raspberry Pi on the London Stock Exchange, which was undoubtedly the success story of 24 when it comes to the city. We have Mark, who 20 years in gasification, starting with coal, then organic, and then to biogenic, and he's the inventor. Sat, literally woke up one morning with a different way of doing it and combined that with the research with supercritical water. We have Professor Oakey from Cranford University, who is chief scientific advisor to many governments around the world. Bright young team. These are the guys that are passionate. These are the ones that have the vision. We've got 18 of us now. And as I say, for the last 3 years, we've been squirreling away, getting this technology proven to a level, and the tires kicked on it. And I'm so proud of this team. They are passionate about climate change. They are passionate about using technology to help us get out of this mess. So to summarize, we're massively investable right now. So we've got a final seed round, which is a £6 million raise. That's filling up really nicely. 2.3 million is already cornerstoned. We did a very successful crowdfunding campaign over Christmas, where we got 120% of that round. That campaign was filled. So we've already opened ourselves up to the scrutiny of the great British and European public and survived that with lots of money coming in. And we've onboarded our industrial partner in the terms of Wales and West Utilities. The next step is a pre-IPO raise, and we're going to IPO before the end of the decade. That will happen. And we're only going to have one series raise, and that's because of the modular nature of this technology. We can get out, we can build these reactors in that factory, and we'll be selling them. We'll be expecting to take our first orders in 2028. So, as I said, we're ready to start shouting from the rooftops. Come and see us on the stand. And the beer, the shower, and the aeroplane, we're talking to breweries. Every pint of beer that you drink, there's 10 pints of effluent, which they pay to be taken away from their site. That effluent is perfect for us. It's got the water in it, it's got some calorific value, it's got organic material. We can give them back heat, cheap fuel, and anything else that they need, building that circular economy. Water companies, they've got a cliff edge where they're not able to spread digestate on the land very soon because of microplastics. Stick your sewage in the reactor, microplastics are gone, and we've got a useful fuel and heat. And believe it or not, aircraft, aeroplanes, and airlines. We're talking to IAG, we're talking to Zero Avia about producing carbon negative flights. So the more you fly, the quicker we solve climate change, completely flipping the thing on its head. So this is what's getting us excited, and we'd love to talk to anyone that wants to come and join us on this journey, whether that's investment, suppliers, partnerships, gas off-takers. I'm keen to talk to as many people as possible, so please come and see us on the stand. Thank you.
James, thanks very much. I'm sure people will have lots of questions for you at the panel session. I'd now like to introduce Robert Bell, CEO of Volta Hydrogen.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. And firstly, thank you to Foresight for inviting me here. There's a bit of history in terms of the company and going back with what we've done over the last couple of years. We're looking at methane pyrolysis as a route to decarbonise the natural gas that we've currently got in our system. And that came about because I was at a Foresight event a couple of years ago and talking about electrification, which is my background, and thinking through what does industry actually need to be able to decarbonise their processes. As I say, I'd worked for 10 years in high-temperature processing, microwaves, induction heating systems, producing those systems for industry. And one of the real challenges that always came across was how do we actually translate that from existing technologies to take that into the market? And because there's some real challenges that industry has that have come up this morning and we've talked about, but I can be split down into the fact that we've got energy-intensive users, we've got complexity about process changes in terms of existing products, and we've got widely dispersed sites. And what does that mean? Well, these sites are high demand. Now, that means that the grid support and infrastructure is set up for those existing processes. They haven't got large amounts of electricity grid capacity to be able to disconnect onto those systems, but they do have existing gas networks. We can generate that heat via the existing processes, but for things like direct fire furnaces, it's difficult to translate that directly into an electrified process. And then we've got huge numbers of large plant that is delivering heat for us 24/7 for a range of users. We talk about distributed demand. Over 50% of the emissions of the UK come away from clusters. So we've got great technologies and applications that are in place for the likes of HyNet, which we heard about earlier, and the stuff around the Humber. And they are great concentrations of big emitters. But we've got hundreds, thousands of sites away from those places where they have still got problems of decarbonisation. They're still big energy users, and they've got an infrastructure that's in place that is not able to meet the demands for decarbonisation. I've got a map there of the transmission network for the gas network, but actually beyond that, you've got the individual distribution, which is going producing from there into the doorstep or onto the site of each of these users. So how do we square that? Are we going to look at putting in parallel systems across the whole of the country for these organisations, or are we going to ask them to move? And that's a difficult question. Third part of that is then the complexity of process change. And it's been brought up about whether these things can be electrified. Is hydrogen the right way to use these in these some of these applications? Well, for many people, it is absolutely the right option, because there are real challenges about understanding what it takes to change a process and what that impact that has on products. We heard about pies earlier and how just a simple change in temperature regime and how thermal conductivity works and how we transfer heat can change the product nature. Now, if we're developing new products and new processes, maybe electrification is the right way to go. But as I say, we've got existing infrastructure in place, existing assets that need to be serviced for the next 20, 30, 40 years, where they're implying real employment opportunities for people as well. If we're going to think about changing those things, like the final part is skills. Do we have enough chemists, engineers, process engineering expertise to go into all those sites? Because they haven't got R&D facilities of their own that can start from scratch and redevelop and reformulate products to meet their existing requirements. It's a real challenge. So we then talk about hydrogen as it's an effective route for that decarbonisation approach. We know it can provide the right conditions for these systems to operate. There's experimental work going on now with the likes of Glass Futures putting in test facilities to do this, and that looks like that's a viable route. But there are real barriers associated with that as well. We've got lack of supply, both in pipeline capacities. We've got high costs for if you're going to transport this by road with either compression or liquefaction. And electrolysis is capital energy intensive. So putting that close to the end user is also difficult. If I go through and back and think about what this means for those customers that I've worked with over the years, they've got a list of requirements which are relatively simple for them, but difficult for us to look at from an energy network and think about how we can do that. They want to be able to have a secure supply, use existing infrastructure as a way to do that. They need to have lower capital costs. They don't want to have to reinvest the whole of their production processes. And they want to do things like limit the amount of hydrogen they have to store on site. We don't want to have lots and lots of coma sites around separated into small towns that can be a problem for that. Additionally, we want to be able to achieve a standard that says that these are low carbon. We don't want to get into the process of having potentially carbon costs associated with this. So having standards that say that's the right way to approach. So going back, what did we come to the conclusion we came to think about that from an industrial perspective? We came to the conclusion that if we can use the existing infrastructure and we can do the chemistry to split that natural gas and do the conversion on the site, we actually have an integrated approach that we can deliver across the country. We can take grid-supplied natural gas, we can take the electricity from the existing network, we can produce hydrogen, and we can produce a solid carbon material. Now, this is a graphite-type particle, which is easy to transport, it's stable, and can go into a wide range of applications. And graphite, as we know, is a critical raw material. The advantage of this is particularly around the amount of energy that we use. To split methane to produce hydrogen, about 37 kilojoules per mole, which is a fraction of what it takes to split water. It's a much easier molecule to break. That means that we can get below 5 kilowatt hours per kilogram of hydrogen. And that's less than 10% of what it would take to split water, to produce water via electrolysis, which means that gives us the route to put this onto people's sites and use the existing constrained electricity network, but still produce clean hydrogen on those sites. When we look at the comparison for this, we can think about both what that means in terms of energy demand, but particularly continued access to the gas network. We talk about reliability of supply. Well, we're not actually interrupting or changing any of the infrastructure that's been in place. We put our facility onto the site of the user. They feed that with natural gas, and hydrogen comes out the other side. If there's a problem or demand increases, we can take additional natural gas from the network and continue their operation so that they have that continued reliability supply that allows them to continue operating profitably. There's no disruption to other network users. Because we're continuing to use the existing natural gas network, we can take one particular user in an area and provide them with hydrogen. It doesn't mean that the domestic users in that area have to switch over or have to change their processes. And that's one of the real challenges that we think about when we look at rolling out this beyond these smaller, these localized regions. How do you bring everyone along at the same time? Do we have to wait for every user in a region to transition their heating to electrified heat pumps before we can turn the natural gas system over to hydrogen? These are real challenges that we need to address. And then the cost. So here you can see a table that gives you operating conditions for an example 8-megawatt site. Now an 8-megawatt site would be not significant in terms of glass industry, but might represent brick or a ceramic industry application, or potentially one of the many food industry applications that we've got in the UK. You can see that when we compare this to either electrolytic hydrogen or to a direct electrified process, the costs based on just standard electrical industrial costs are far lower. We're talking about half the cost of just the energy cost of direct electrification, and less than a third if we're talking about electrolytic hydrogen. Compared to electrolytic hydrogen as well, we've got a much more simple approach. It's a relatively simple pressure vessel that contains all this. So our capital costs are going to be less than 20% of that for a high volume electrolytic production. Also, because we're doing this conversion on the site, all that heat that we're generating to do the conversion can actually be used. We can take that and push that into steam production to substitute some of the natural gas demand that would have gone into the site. And again, the high quality carbon product that we produce has value that can be sold to offset some of the additional costs that you've got in terms of the natural gas. So, just to give you a little bit on the background of the technology. I didn't want to go too deeply into this, although we could probably talk about this for a long time, but it's a very simple process. We take an electric heated bed of carbon, we pass natural gas through that, it decomposes, the carbon deposits onto those existing particles, which we extract, and the natural gas exits out of the reactor. The control system and all the equipment that we use here is using standard electrical equipment, so power control systems that are used industrially already. We haven't got any specific materials, there's no catalysts involved, and in terms of the overall structure, these are using materials and heat exchangers that are, again, readily available and on the market at the moment. The idea is that we can take this as a modular system of 2 to 3 megawatts, containerize that, transport that from a central manufacturing facility, and put that onto the industrial user's site. It can be plug and play, ready to go very quickly, and because it's using their existing infrastructure and gas connections, there is relatively little change that we need from that end user site. They might need to change burners to dual fuel systems, but again, that's been proven technology and shows that we can develop that quite quickly. So that's how we're going to approach the capital costs. The other part is then meeting the low carbon hydrogen standard. Now, I'm aware that natural gas has, in the production of it, some embedded CO2 emissions that come from that. And that, quite rightly, has to be wrapped up into a carbon standard that incorporates all of those things, just as we would with any other approach. What you can see in the graph here is that over time, as the electricity network is decarbonized, taking an average annual carbon intensity of the electricity network, in 2013, we wouldn't meet the low carbon hydrogen standard of 20 grams of CO2 per megajoule of hydrogen produced. But since 2018, that decarbonisation, the use of more renewables, has allowed that to drop significantly, so that now we are well below that 20 grams of CO2, and that's going to continue to drop, even as we import more liquefied natural gas into the network, which is actually increasing the carbon intensity of the natural gas as we go forward. We still achieve that low carbon standard. And that's incredibly important, because it means that then we can meet the requirements of industry. We've got a system that uses existing infrastructure. We're not waiting 10, 20 years for new pipelines or new electricity grid infrastructure to come into place. We've got a high security supply, because we are, again, connected to those systems that have got built-in capacity. We don't have to store the hydrogen. We can produce that on-site, on-demand, as it's required. It's a flick of a switch. We can achieve the low-carbon hydrogen standard as well. And the constraints that are associated with some of those other potential options are taken away. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't have electrolytic hydrogen for those applications where it makes sense, as we discussed earlier, or that blue hydrogen isn't relevant for places where we've got very large energy users around refineries and the high net systems and things like that. But what we're talking about is being able to transition the rest of industry quickly to a position where they can take existing infrastructure and convert an existing process and convert them. The process we've developed is particularly efficient. That comes back to the experience that we've had in terms of developing low-carbon processes from an electrical perspective. It fulfills the requirements of industry, and it's not limited by geography or resource, and it's deployable now. So hopefully that's an interesting approach to Volta Hydrogen and what we're doing, and happy to have discussions later on as we go forward. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Robert. I'd just like to now invite Stephen Coates, the Commercial Manager for X Energy, to the podium for the last speaker of this session. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm a little bit of a nuclear cuckoo in the hydrogen nest today. Which provides a fantastic opportunity to hopefully land some key messages around nuclear and how nuclear can support hydrogen production and a decarbonisation effort. So some of the messages I'd like to hopefully leave you with today when I get through the presentation are there are schools of thought that the next generation of nuclear reactors, Generation 4 reactors, which is what the X Energy is, are in an R&D phase and they won't be deployable for the next 10, 15 years in the UK. What I'll present in the first few slides hopefully will give you confidence that's not the case, what's happening in the United States and beyond. Secondly, that we are not advocates that we are the solution to global warming. It'd be foolish to say that. But we are advocates of we provide part of the solution to the global to global warming, which comes on to which you, I think it was the HyNet presentation this morning, really energised me when I seen the word collaboration. I think collectively, whichever energy sector you work in, and support to make sure that our global warming, our global climate change ambitions. Internationally, nationally, globally, we can't do it individually. It's got to be a collaborative effort across every sector. So we're a collaborative organisation. We want to work with other sectors, other industries, and ultimately, it may sound a little bit twee, but we want to give the planet to our next generation, our children, our grandchildren, a better place than it is today. And that's what we want to contribute to. So spend the next 5 or 10 minutes or so going through who XNG are, what we do, and then a little bit on how we can support hydrogen production. So who are we? An American-based company formed in 2009, based out of Rockville in Maryland, USA, with offices in Canada and the UK. We're based in Warrington, our headquarters in the UK are in Warrington, at Birchwood Park, and that's like largely because it's a bit of a nuclear hub, and our UK deployment partners, Cavendish Nuclear, have got their headquarters in Warrington Park, so some good synergies for basing ourselves out of Warrington Park. In the US, we've been granted $1.2 billion worth of federal funding from the Advanced Reactor Demonstration Program, and I'll come into how we're spending that. Raising capital and around 400 employees, but that's ramping up. The main body of the employees in the US, but we've got Canada and the UK where we've got employees. The 400 employees is ramping up on a month-by-month basis massively, and I'll cover why that is in the next few slides. So what is the technology? It's a Generation 4 high-temperature gas cooled reactor. Each reactor is 80 megawatts electrical, 200 megawatts thermal. The fuel on the sort of top left there, you can see it's TRISO-X fuel. It's a pebble, 60 millimetres in diameter, tri-structural isotropic fuel. Which there are 200,000 pebbles in each reactor core. And when the reactor fission process starts, the heat is removed, and you see the two arrows running down the center of the reactor. Heat is removed by helium, passed over a steam generator, and the steam is at nominally 150 bar, 565 degrees C. Now, where we differ from the baseload stations that you see in the UK at the moment, the Sizewell C's, the Hartlepools, Heatsiums, etc., is this, the energy can be used for either power generation onto the grid, private wire, PPAs, etc., or you can off-take the steam before it goes into the generator and use the steam for several other uses. It's modular by design, so we've done some assessments with Cavendish Nuclear on the modularity of it and assessments on transportation. And the fuel, it's been described as by the DOE in the United States, Department of Energy, as it's intrinsically safe and the safest fuel on the planet. Now, I'm not a big favorite of that statement because I've had a lifetime in nuclear, and that's not to say that other fuel in other reactors is less safe. They just say this is intrinsically safe, and by nature, what that means ultimately is the emergency planning zone for these reactors is at the site fence. So they're going to be deployed local to industrial clusters in higher density population areas than the current fleet of reactors. So the $1.2 billion worth of Advanced Reactor Demonstration Program funding has been spent in two areas. The first one I want to talk about is this. Dow Chemicals in the Seadrift site on the Gulf of Mexico. It's a nominal 5,000-acre site with 8 production plants. Their current power supply, their current power station is fossil fuel, and it goes into retirement in the early 2030s. So they've got into partnership with X Energy, and they bought a 4-pack. The reactors, we sell them in packs of 4, 8, and 12 for scalability and cost. And they're buying a 4-pack, which is 320 megawatts of electrical power and 800 megawatts of thermal power. And they're going to use that for direct wire electricity onto the site. They're going to use it for steam offtake for their process use, and they've also got the capability to export under the US grid. So it really demonstrates the agility of the XE100 reactor design and how it can support direct wire electricity, steam offtake for process use, and contributing to a US grid. The second area that we're, I haven't got a slide on, but the second area where the $1.2 billion is being used is the manufacture and construction, design, manufacture, construction of a fuel fabrication facility in Tennessee. You may have heard in October last year, a big investment by Amazon and a number of others, but Amazon are the sort of the big name that that comes to mind. Amazon have invested $500 million of equity into X Energy in the United States, and that's to complete the final design analysis and more importantly, the final steps of the licensing process in the United States. They've also looking to buy 5 gigawatts of electrical output, that's 62 reactors, and they want that by 2039, and that's probably no, well, no surprise, that's to support their data centers and the power demands that the data centers are going to predictedly or they predict are going to be in the future. And the second project after Dow is with Energy Northwest, and that's a collaboration with X Energy, Amazon, Energy Northwest, and that'll be a 12 reactor construction site in Washington State, and that is to provide electrical production for data centers. In the UK, what do we want? What's our ambition in the UK? A minimum of 40 reactors, XE100s, that's 3.2 gigawatts of electrical generation, 8 gigawatts of thermal power. Our ambition is to have an 80% UK content through the supply chain with first generation in the early 2030s. We also want UK fuel for UK reactors. So we are looking at exploring what that means in terms of a fuel fabrication facility in the United Kingdom. And our first site, I'll not go into the far right graphic there, that was just a study done in 2015 on potential sites for new nuclear. Our first site in the UK, our preferred first site where we're targeting, is Hartlepool in the northeast. And the reason for on the existing nuclear power plant in the northeast, and there are a number of reasons for that why we targeted Hartlepool. And that will bring in about around £20 billion of inward investment into the UK, a fleet of 40 reactors. In April last year, we were awarded through the Future Nuclear Enabling Fund, which was a UK government, His Majesty's government-led initiative. We were given a match-funded award, £6.68 million, £3.34 from the government, £3.34 from X Energy. And the work is to run through to March 2025, although there is the potential that we may extend that to do some licensing work or pre-engagement work with the regulator beyond March 2025. Four key work streams: UK design baseline. So as we transition the design of the XE100 across the Atlantic from America into the US, what potential licensing gaps will a UK regulator need to fill? And say we're doing some work with the regulator on that. Manufacturing and supply chain, how do we procure and manufacture the plants? And then construction feasibility, how do we build it? And then as a responsible owner and operator, how do you manage to spend fuel at the end of life and through its life as well? And you can see there we've signed a number of MOUs with a number of organizations there who are supporting them for work streams in some way, shape, or form. So, XE100, safe, reliable generation through nuclear power, can support conventional power generation in steam for industrial use, whether that's glass, paper, steel manufacture, a whole host of other uses, synthetic aviation fuels, desalination, data center we talked about, load following capability, so it can load follow, and district heating. And they're all avenues or areas that we're looking at. Today, I'd like to talk a little bit about clean hydrogen production. So I've spent the first 7 slides in my comfort zone, and I'm looking at you guys out there. Now we're going to talk a little bit about hydrogen, so bear with me. certainly not the detail that's been on our previous presentations, but that doesn't matter because it's about how we can provide the energy, whether that's electrical or steam, to support you guys to produce hydrogen. So you see that a much simpler graphic than you've seen previously. You've got the XE100 reactor there producing steam, and the steam can be used for steam offtake, as I said, or electrical production. And then we put on there sort of cold water proton exchange, an alkaline electrolysis, heat-assisted solid oxide electrolysis, and thermochemical hydrogen production. We are cognizant of the technology readiness levels of some of these technologies, but what we want to do is through this type of conference and today and going forward is to open up conversations with potential off-takers, so we can understand what your needs are in more detail, and you can better understand how X Energy can support that. Why nuclear? You've got high capacity primary energy source, so you talk about a nuclear reactor unit capability factor, so how it operates in the high 90s, 99%. In fact, Dow Chemicals want greater than 99% availability. They've got a 24/7 process, so the XE100 could support that in terms of 99% unit capability factor. And you notice packs of four, so that gives you, we never shut them all down at any one time. Only one reactor will be shut down for periodic maintenance, so you've always got capability for steam and electricity. I see you've got that 24/7 output. Onload refueling capability, so the only reason we shut down is for periodic maintenance outages. We're cost competitive, and we bring strong socioeconomic benefits. So, I've talked about a little bit about electricity, but it's the hydrogen numbers there, just indicative numbers. One XE100 can support the production of around 16,000 tonnes of hydrogen per year, and a 12-pack, around 189,000 tonnes of hydrogen a year. So we put that together with the electrical output, but wanted to just focus in on the hydrogen content of that, and then we put some indicative numbers of potential projects that are coming to market in the UK. This, I'm certainly not going to get into the detail of this. I wanted to extract this from a UK hydrogen strategy paper that the government produced in 2021. And I'm not going to go into the table on the right, but on the left-hand side there, you know, you see we've circled nuclear and the nuclear element, and as it flows upwards, how you can support the production of hydrogen, the distribution, the onward distribution, and then onto the end users, so industry, power, heating buildings and transport. Everything that I covered on two or three slides back. So nuclear is recognised by this strategy paper as a potential for hydrogen production and support of hydrogen production, and then the flow through to ultimately to the end user. And in conclusion, the XE100 offers a robust fuel design and a proven technology for which UK projects will not be first of a kind. When we deploy in the UK, we'll be likely fifth of a kind. So all the learning from experience in the US will be transitioned into the programme for the to UK, which will give us greater confidence in schedule and cost. Regional growth and development for hydrogen. We bring an opportunity to bring together energy producers with end users using the hydrogen business model, the SAF mandate, as hydrogen as a feedstock and renewable transport fuels obligation. We've got strong support from the government. NIRO, which is the Nuclear Innovation and Research Office, produced a report on advanced modular reactor technology technical assessment in 2021, July 2021, and stated high temperature gas reactors, which the XE100 is, are the preferred His Majesty's Government supported technology. And we provide improved overall bankability, consistent long-term production, so there's 99% availability, a proven technology, which I hope I've landed that message from my presentation, and a strong regulatory regime. And that's it, thank you.
this is working. Now, I don't know if anybody has any questions. Does anybody want to start? Stunned silence. Let me kind of kick this off then. Question to Wild Hydrogen. Very interesting presentation. I've got a couple of questions, I suppose, that are related. One is, would you see competition for feedstock compare with existing technology like anaerobic digestion? And another one is, one challenge for waste-based processes like gasification is the heterogeneous nature of the feedstock. How flexible is your process in dealing with those types of kind of varying feedstocks?
Okay, yeah, thank you. Now, you might say, I would say this, but we can take a huge spectrum of feedstock. Anaerobic digesters, you're feeding fussy bacteria. Typically, they're 27 to 32% efficient in terms of conversion efficiency. Supercritical water reforming is 98% efficient. So I would argue there's no better place to, if you've got biogenic material, there's no better place to put it than in our reactor in terms of converting it into useful molecules. I think your second question was about the heterogeneous nature.
So we're
on a journey here. We've got this breakthrough technology. You can imagine with the prototypes we've got and the team we're doing, then we're trying all sorts of different feedstocks. And we're getting some really interesting results. So food contaminated plastic, for example, which is recyclable plastic by nature because it's got its food packaging, only 50% of that, believe it or not, is recycled. And that's because it's contaminated with food. And we're like, well, the more food contamination, the better. Bring it on. It's organic material we can turn into useful molecules. Another point is, I found out only last week, in the UK, 1 in 8 lorries on the road is transporting waste, whether that's human waste, plastic waste, MSW, whatever it is. 1 in 8 of those lorries are transporting waste. And that's either being transported from where that waste is produced to other places, and then they do a bit of processing, and then they transport the next lot of waste. Green wheelie bin waste is a huge carbon footprint. So all of these streams, we're really interested in. It's the streams that others can't take. So if we take Drax, for example, they need dried, really good quality wood chip. So very, very specific. They're burning millions and millions of tons of that every year at an efficiency, which is very difficult to establish, but it's somewhere between 17 and 25% efficient. They're getting loads of subsidies. They're getting hundreds of millions of pounds from the UK taxpayer. I think the time is right for us to support, breakthrough technologies in the UK, and that's what we're about. So, yeah, it's a good question on the feedstock.
Okay, thanks, James. We have a question. Oh, we have a couple. This gentleman on the right, the side, I think his hand came up first.
Thank you. Charles Prestori, Principal Engineer, Progressive Energy. A question for Volta Hydrogen around what happens if you have hydrogen in your gas feed? So looking ahead towards, hydrogen blending in the networks is a decision that the government have made. And a second kind of question. So as I understand it, your technology is quite similar to HiiROC and others that produce solid carbon effectively from the pyrolysis. What differentiates you versus other companies that make the same kind of technology? Thank you.
So first things first on gas blending. Yes, we've tested this with gas blends in the lab. So there's about 18 months of laboratory research that got us to the point where we're now scaling up. We don't see a problem. I mean, we obviously, some of that volume will go straight through the reactor. We're not producing any byproducts from that. So yes, you're heating that hydrogen up, but in terms of the overall efficiency of the process and the energy cost to do that, it's actually relatively small because we recover the heat on the output anyway. So it seems like that is not going to be an issue, and I think we would welcome the fact that 20% of hydrogen coming through the system is reasonable for us to work on. In terms of the difference of what we're doing, what we've focused on is producing a system that we can modularize and actually have on the end user site. So the difference with HYROX and Lividian and other companies is a lot of those products are thinking about producing that carbon product first, hydrogen being a byproduct. And therefore, the value is in producing that small structured carbon. The problem when you then think about what's that like from a distributed manufacturing perspective is you've got to then capture, transport, package, and take that away. What we're being able to do is to minimize the size of the reactor, increase the efficiency, so we don't have to have any alternate gases. There's no inert gas flow through with the plasma system that you might need. And we produce a graphitic carbon that's solid and dense. So the example of the 8-megawatt site that we're looking at there, that would produce somewhere around 5,000 tons a year of solid carbon product. Now, if that's in the form of carbon nanoparticles or a carbon nanotube, that is a huge volume. For us, it's a couple of containers a week of solid carbon product, which we can then take away. And in terms of the market application, when you think about the size of these markets that we're dealing with, you know, potentially 20, 30, 100 sites, all producing thousands of tons a year, we need big applications for that markets. Now, the graphite we produce is a critical raw material, so that will go into things like EV batteries or other graphite applications where there are large and existing markets for that material. Under the UK low carbon hydrogen business model, that prevents some of those applications being valid because we're looking at primarily sequestration of that carbon, so landfill or sequestration into mineralized cement products. But there's the potential there that, depending on the regime and how that works, to actually bring that cost of hydrogen down by subsidizing that cost with those added value carbon products that you've got as well.
Roy Calder from Aviva. One of the takeaways I got from this morning's earlier session was that there doesn't seem to be very much joined up thinking inside our government at the moment. However, when I look at the four gentlemen sitting here, I see the potential for joined up thinking. Now, allied to what the government said, I think it was yesterday, about nuclear power and lowering the barriers for nuclear power being distributed across the UK, how do the panel see themselves working in collaboration? Because there's your electricity, there's your steam, you've got the technology, you've got the ability to transport the stuff around to where it's needed. Seems like logical thinking, but then I'm Scottish.
Yeah, so, you know, humans are tribal, aren't they? So we all like to put on a different coloured shirt and then compete with one another. We've got a common enemy here, which is climate change and, you know, industrial progress that's been amazing, but we don't want to leave a legacy for our children. So we all need to join up, and I think, you know, as we're understanding, and I'm understanding this, we shouldn't be competing with one another. We need to establish green, amazing technologies on all fronts, and governments that should be there to support everyone at the same time, actually, and let capitalism do its work, you know, and the rising stars will come to the top. So I'm a very firm believer in that, actually, and it's about creating the environment for that to happen. But we should all join up, and together we can find solutions. And just a tiny other point, sorry. If you look at today's energy landscape, there's not one silver bullet that's giving us energy. There's many, many different forms of energy that's working, and so I don't see that changing. It's just that the energy needs to evolve, and we need to evolve into a low carbon or decarbonized energy situation going forward. But it will be with many different technologies. I'm certain of that.
So I completely agree with your sentiment, but we're looking at it from the other end of the telescope, if that's the right analogy, it might not be, in terms of we see it as our responsibility to work with other technologies, with the government, to demonstrate what we call an energy stack, a technology stack. So we could be the front end where we provide the electricity, the steam, then you've got synthetic aviation fuel, hydrogen production, then you go on to end users, district heating, how we build them technology stacks and demonstrate to the government that we're a viable proposition. That one is a good business need, but ultimately what you've said is how we tackle climate change collectively. And I think you've got to have, from my perspective, that's what's always, it's at the front of my mind, not the back of the mind. What are we doing this for? Well, we're all businessmen, I guess, but we're doing this to prevent climate change damaging the planet. And I think if you've got that mindset, then, and you've got that ethos, then you can come together collectively, still have an effective business. So we're looking at development, DevCos, things like that, where other investors come in, which are non-nuclear industry, and that's fine. That's what we want. We want other industries to get on board and work collectively. So I think, from an X-Energy perspective, what do? We recognise some of the frustrations that seem to be there, real or perceived, from government in terms of moving forward. Our attitude is we'll make this happen. We'll go out and make this happen collectively, and we'll demonstrate to the government that it's a viable opportunity and you should get on board. So if that makes sense.
And just to reinforce that, I think it's, like you say, it's the whole value chain that we're talking about. And I think that we're all involved in a different part of that. We've got our different hats on and can see a different part of it. And each of us have got those different perspectives on that government approach. And we understand that, you know, asking for a holistic and well-constructed approach from government is one thing. But then we're also talking about potentially international regimes as well. You know, why, that is going to drive potentially different solutions as well. So I think it has to be collaborative. We're looking for partners to work with to go forward, and that's end users, so we can think about how we can make our process more efficient and more aligned with their needs. But that's at every step, and I think everything we do.
I was just going to add to what you were saying there, because obviously exactly what you're saying there is why we targeted the area that we're targeting. And there is a lot of high-level look at development of hydrogen across the industry, where it's going to, but we felt there was a gap that how do you get there? And that in itself, and the efficiency of how you deliver energy and how you deliver your hydrogen from point A to point B or even to point C, is where a lot of this industry may be made or broken. Because some of the larger projects we've seen haven't thought about that last step. They've thought about where it's going and who's doing it. But when we came to the table, we didn't see that solution for that. We've seen it around Europe, we've seen it in other places, but like I say, the UK recently transferred into their own body, and there still isn't that solution. Like I say, our aim is to become the first supplier of Type 4 vessels in this country, and we generally feel that where everybody's advancing, we're still going to be able to speak to everybody and still be able to work together to provide the best solution. So it's what you're saying. There needs to be that joined up thinking across industry.
If you don't mind me commenting on the question too, I think the industry as a whole, my experience is, I think it's very collaborative. I think the HyNet presentation that Chris gave this morning demonstrates, with the number of companies he showed on the slide, demonstrates that level of collaboration. I think the industry is very happy to collaborate. I think what becomes a bit of a challenge is when, you know, kind of the government departments like DESNZ want to carve up that supply chain into production, storage, transport, and then you have to compete on each little individual element of that. It kind of counters that approach that the industry is already doing. So. Do we have any more? Oh, there's one at the back.
Thank you very much. Ben Laws from Siemens. Perhaps a question more towards James and Rob. At this stage in the game, you're obviously thinking about distributed use of the technology, perhaps with very, very diverse inputs and scenarios. So could you give a bit more colour on how you see the operation, the management, the maintenance of these distributed facilities? Is that something that will be managed centrally by your companies, by the users of that technology, a mix of the two? How do you see that kind of evolving, maybe as the scale obviously increases and hopefully increases quite substantially?
take that. I mean, this is one thing we've thought about all the way through, which is how do we make this relevant for industrial user? And I think for the markets we're looking at, we are not going to expect a company in the food or beverage processing market to take on a piece of chemical plant and operate it. The whole operating model we're looking at is that we will own and operate those pieces of equipment. You know, we've seen this done through other routes with special purpose vehicles for investment in each individual site, and there may be some partnering with the potential user as well within that, but that we would retain the ownership and operation of that. And that's one of the key drivers for making sure that the technology is simple and reliable. And that's going to be the key focus going forward. We've got to keep those costs down. That's not just the energy cost going in, but it's a complete operating cost for that life cycle development of that technology.
I'll just add to that, because in addition to, our technology is well suited to a sort of circular economy. So I talked about breweries and water treatment works, for example. But what we've also realised just this last year, really, and the realisation of greening up our gas grid. And if you think about the journey that we've been on with our electricity grid, and as a country, we do not shout enough about this. I mean, it's incredible. We turned off the, you know, first G7 country to turn off coal-powered fire stations before Christmas. First thing that happened the week later, everyone was going on about complaining about energy from waste. But we should pause and celebrate these things. 50% of our electricity were green electrons last year. Incredible. You know, I think we're second only to Scandinavia. So I want to do the same with molecules. So you've got embedded generation with solar and wind in the electricity grid. So let's have embedded generation for gas molecules. And there's a well-trodden path there, which is anaerobic digesters, 600 in the UK, that are currently injecting. It's only 2% of our gas grid. As I mentioned, Denmark are there at 40%. France want to go to 100% very rapidly. So, utilising existing fossil fuel infrastructure and decarbonising it seems to me to make sense. Those assets are in the ground, and we should reuse them. I mean, similar to yourself. I think that there's big industrials that can benefit from local generation and within a circular economy, stopping the waste trucks on the road, and then there's embedded generation using the gas infrastructure.
I thought there was another question on this side.
Yeah, over here.
Hi, it was a question for Stephen, please, in regard to the rollout of the 40 reactors by the 2030s, I think you said. And you said the planning perimeter was at the fence. Has this been tested in the UK? I was just thinking, would the challenge be the fracking situation? I know it's not comparable, but the way the USA is a lot bigger and different planning.
Such a really good question. So has it been tested in the UK? I'll come on to that, but if I just give you the context where we are in the US, the construction license application for the Dow Chemicals site will be submitted in Q1 this year, and to the US NRC, so that's a regulator, or an R equivalent, with the expectation that that license is issued, construction license is issued. Once a construction license is issued in the US, that takes you through to operations, well, construction into operation. And there's a nominal 5-year period for construction to the first reactor into operation. So that sets the context in the US. In the UK, it's a very good question, but the ONR recognised that the next generation of reactors are different to the current fleet of reactors operating in the UK, and therefore a different framework is needed. It doesn't reduce the safety element of it, certainly not, but they recognise the needs of the next generation reactors are different to the current generation. So what are they doing about that? Well, they're internally reviewing their GDA process and how we can make it more efficient and effective. And two, they're working with Canada and the United States regulators to do regulatory harmonisation, they're calling it. Now, I think it'd be foolish to think that any country would take 100% harmonisation, but some of the key components could be regulated once for three countries. That's North America, Canada, and the United Kingdom. So that will bring the timescales down for licensing as well. With respect to the emergency planning zone, the regulator knows where the emergency planning zone is. I'm sure there'll be challenges going forward on that. But again, they are open to a different discussion compared to the existing fleet. So do we see it as a clear run through to licensing? No, there'll be challenges. But what we do hear and see from the regulator is recognition that this next generation are different to the current and previous generations, and therefore they've got a different outlook as well. So it's very encouraging signs, but I'm sure there'll be challenges along the way.
I just think as soon as you mention the word nuclear, people go into meltdown, don't they, and panic?
Sorry?
As soon as you mention the word nuclear in a residential area or something, people will go into panic.
I believe tomorrow there's... We submitted as part of the last year, there was a consultation on siting. It's got EN6, which is an appendix to a planning policy about nuclear. The government revising EN6 because that just looks at existing nuclear sites to build on for new build. And there's not enough real estate for 24 gigawatts of new nuclear by 2050 on the existing sites. So the government recognised that, and they've put a consultation out for go from EN6 to EN7. And one of the things that we're really keen to see is the assessment with respect to population density and whether there's any change in thinking with respect to population density, because that massively affects us. So, you know, we believe that because of the intrinsically safe nature of the fuel and because of the site emergency planning zone, then the population density, we've got to be cognizant of it and we've got to respect and understand it, but it's different to the fleet of existing reactors. So I thought you said meltdown there. I
did, yeah. Sorry, wrong word.
So so lots of challenges, but lots of opportunities as well.
Thank you.
I think there's a question just in front.
Yeah, go on. Sorry, I'll have another one unless anyone wants one. Question for James, only fair since I asked Robert about blended hydrogen, ask yourselves. So you're proposing to basically inject into the grid your biomethane product and then eventually hydrogen if that's the way that policy goes. How have you made any assessment as to the impact of a blended hydrogen network in terms of your capacity to get into the grid, either with biomethane because of kind of calorific value constraints or in terms of hydrogen, in terms of capacity up to the 20% limit or wobby limits, that kind of thing. And then a second different-ish question, more on the collaboration theme. So I might have missed it in your presentation, so apologies, was around what you're planning to do with the CO2 and whether it's kind of you're envisaging road transport because of scales or if you're envisaging kind of more an aggregated concept and therefore pipelines or rail kind of solutions, thinking towards, you know, where it might go into an infrastructure like HyNet and other clusters for CCS. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So a couple of points there. So first one, the paid pilot we've got with Wales and West is to do exactly what you suggested. We're very confident that we've got a quality of gas that can go into the gas grid. We want this paid pilot to prove that. And also how we can move the technology to do a hydrogen blend. All the talk now is actually about taking gas out of the gas grid, blending it, and then re-injecting it. So our technology is quite well suited to that, and that's what this paid pilot. So within 7 months from today, we will have that all. We'll have the empirical data to support that claim. And your second point was about, sorry...
about the CO2 and how you envisage that getting CO2 away.
So the nice thing about our carbon negative technology means that we could release the CO2. So if it's not economic to make that CO2 and sequester it, we can release it and still be net zero. So we've got a negative carbon intensity. It's about 350 grams CO2 per kilowatt hour. If you look at natural gas, it's typically plus 350 grams. These distributed units that where we may struggle to transport CO2, then we may either turn it into food grade and sell it, or release it comfortably. Very, very interested, obviously, in talking to HyNet. Teesside and others. We're based in, down in the southwest, so Avonmouth has got a CO2 little cluster going on there with a company called 7CO2, which is putting a pipeline in for, so we would tag into that. So, yeah, it's a good question, but there's lots of technologies out there, and CO2 sequestration, we would just piggyback on what exists.
Okay, any more questions from the audience? Well, like last time, I'm going to ask one last question of Stephen. You mentioned in your slides about the kind of competitive cost of the power generated from your reactor. Can you give us any kind of feel for that, how it compares to, you know, kind of conventional reactors, or even, you know, kind of compared to renewable power?
Yes. So, well, this is going to be sound like a quite a sloppy shoulder answer. Yes, we will be as competitive as the existing nuclear fleet, and we'll be as competitive as renewables. If you want to talk detail, we'll sign an NDA.
Okay. Fine. On that kind of close out, I'll draw this session to a close. If you can thank the speakers. Please go and enjoy your lunch and do some great networking, and we'll see you back here at 2:00. Thank you very much.